This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's episode, Jane Ayres will be here later on to talk about her article in the USDF Connection magazine on evaluating the extravagant trot. And later on, we'll also be hearing from the US equestrian team veterinarian Dr. Richard Mitchell about nutrition and preventative vaccinations for the sport horse. And before we get to our first item of news this week, we would like to remind you that the views of guests and the hosts of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDF or its members. And our first item of news is that the United States Equestrian Federation has announced the combinations that will represent the U.S. at the 2016 Longines FEI WBFSH World Breeding Dressage Championships for Young Horses held in Ermelo, the Netherlands, from July 28th through the 31st. The following combinations will represent the U.S. in the six-year-old division of the 2016 championships: Endel Otts from Wellington, Florida, and Max Oates, Lucky Strike. And David Whiteman from Murrieta, California, riding Kathleen Raines, Silberfell. And the U.S. Equestrian Federation has also announced that the 2016 USEF Dressage Grand Prix and Intermedia 1 National Championships will now be held from October the 12th through the 16th, 2016, at the Paso Robles Horse Park in Paso Robles, California. The Grand Prix and Intermedia 1 National Championships are a part of the U.S. Dressage Festival of Champions, which is divided between two competitions: the Pony Rider, Junior, Young Rider, and Young Adult Brentina Cup Championships will coincide with the Markel USEF Young and Developing Horse Dressage National Championships taking place at the Lamplight Equestrian Center in Wayne, Illinois, from August the 24th through the 28th. For qualifying information and selection procedures for the 2016 USEF Dressage National Championships, please visit the USEF.org. And now, in our continuing series on American dressage legends, we remember Sarah Sally Swift, who was inducted into the USDF Roma Foundation Hall of Fame in 2006 in recognition of her articulate genius as a riding instructor, her strong commitment to rider education, and outstanding contributions to equitation theory over four decades. Sally Swift's legendary book, Centered Riding, which was published in 1985, was translated into 14 languages and sold more than 500,000 copies. This book enabled everyone in every body type on every horse to enjoy riding better in a correct seat. Sally has been a quiet ambassador for a more harmonious connection between horse and riding. Centered Riding is a school of thought and a training method which incorporates Tai Chi, the martial arts, and the Alexander Technique, which is a theory of mind-body connection, among other things. Sally's ideas were inspired in part by the physical therapy she received as a child with scoliosis at the hands of Miss Mabel Ellsworth Todd. The term, centered riding, is the essence of the balance seat, riding that enables riders to be in relaxed balance and harmony with their horses, as well as having body awareness. All this is due to Sally's solid grasp of human and equine biomechanics. The significant gift that her equitation theory has lent to the world has enabled riders of all levels and backgrounds to embrace the basics of dressage. The concept of having horses work and perform in a happy manner has been the cornerstone of her teaching from the start and has benefited generations of horses and riders. Her book, Centered Riding, published in 1985, has been translated into 14 languages, and Centered Riding 2, which was published in 2003, has been translated into 8 languages. Centered Riding has sold more than 500,000 copies. A German magazine stated that Centered Riding is the most important equestrian work since Xenophon. Sally wrote the book that allowed everyone in every body, on every horse, to enjoy better riding in a correct seat. Having been a member of the New England Dressage Association from its inception, Sally has had a remarkable influence on riders and instructors in that GMO. What sets her apart from the masses of regional instructors is the literal blanketing of the nation and the world with clinics and her commitment to teaching instructors how to teach normal and handicap riders, which has changed how people ride and think about riding. People flocked to her clinics all over the US as she helped many with their riding problems brought about by accidents, bad-fitting saddles, tension, or a physical imbalance. She saw what riders' bodies were doing to constrict their horses and was able to help them find a way to allow the horse to move to its potential. Sally taught at USDF Violet Hopkins seminars with Major Anders Lindgren, Colonel Aig Summer, and Mariel Barnett. The dressage community has directly benefited from her teaching influential instructors such as Jane Savoy, Lendon Gray, and Robin Brookman. According to Lendon, quote, "Sally has had a wonderful influence on dressage in the US and around the world. She has brought techniques of finding the correct position and feel to riders of all levels, but most importantly to adult amateurs who are so often struggling with years of bad habits and fears. She has brought a system of teaching to an activity which has so little direction in how to teach. She has generously shared her grasp of teaching theory and extraordinary communication skills through her active involvement with the American Riding Instructors Program, where she was honored with their Lifetime Achievement Award. She has mentored her own Riding Instructor Certificate curriculum for centered riding instructors. Sally has coached many people riding at the national levels in dressage and eventing, such as Lendon Gray, Denny Emerson, Marcia Kulak, Priscilla Endicott, and members of the Perkins family. But the list of her competitive students is a fraction of the grassroots and amateur dressage riders who have prospered from her tutelage. This is where she clearly made the largest contribution. Her theories certainly have trickled down from the top, but more importantly, have educated and enabled the riders at the base of sport immensely. Through 4 decades of teaching and powerful influential writing, Sally has been instrumental in developing a broad base of appreciation and understanding of riding dressage in the US. She has served as a role model through her exemplary consistent conduct and empathy towards her students and their horses. Her national influence at the grassroots level has helped thousands of riders improve their riding through her presentation of clear education and equine biomechanics. She has also improved the teaching of riding instructors all over the country. And next in our education segment, we're joined by Jane Ayres, who is an FEI 4-star dressage and young horse judge and L program faculty member. She is here to expand on her article, Evaluating the Extravagant Trot, which is published in the March issue of the USDF Connection magazine, and you can also find the entire article on eTrack. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you write from time to time for the magazine, I understand, as a member of the L faculty. Talk a little bit about your background so we get to know you and our wider audience gets to know who you are and what you do in the sport.
Well, I spent many years competing at all levels and then became a judge in actually the mid-1970s. And so I've been doing the judging for a long time, became an FEI judge in 1989, and I'm a 4-star judge at this time, and judge not only in the United States, but in many other countries of the world. I've also had a facility which has had a history of both the training and especially the teaching of riders. We also raised Westfalen horses for over 20 years, so I've been very involved with the breeding of dressage horses as well. So I have kind of a background in many aspects of dressage sport.
And you're based where, Jane? Where could people find you?
Near Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in a town called Dousman.
Right. And is there a name to your business? Can they find you online?
Hearthstone Farm.
Hearthstone Farm. All right.
Hearth as in fireplace hearth. Yep.
There you go. In the Midwest. All right. So we're going to be talking about the article that you wrote for the magazine about the extravagant trot, because every dressage rider wants to produce an extravagant trot, don't they?
Well, I think so. That's really part of what we look for in a good dressage horse. And so we start at some of our lower levels, working towards that, and then of course you see it always at the Grand Prix level.
Well, let's talk about the basics then. What were the fundamental points that you were making in the article, Jane?
Well, the article arose from a question that was written in to the Dressage Connection. It was a person who was concerned about the fact that videos of the modern dressage horse indicate that the horse's trot, when it's doing actually any really uphill kind of trot, whether it's a collected one, but more particularly in the extended trot, tends to not be precisely two beats in its landing on the ground. In other words, the hind feet land a little bit ahead of the front feet when the horse is really balanced onto the hindquarters. And our dressage books for many, many years, including our rule books, have indicated that the trot is supposed to be a two-beat gait. And so this person was very concerned that the trot of today, of a really top dressage horse, was not meeting the criteria. And so I explored that in the article as to what we actually mean by the uphill balance and the cadence and what we're looking for in the horses of today.
Why don't you pull out some of those points then, Jane, for us and highlight what you mean by that?
Well, the idea that the horse should have a parallel position of the hind canon with the radius of the forearm during a trot extension is still very much in effect. The idea of a horse moving more in front than behind, in other words, with a lot of reach in front and much less reach behind, so that those two portions of the horse are no longer parallel, it hasn't really changed. But it's a little... But what has happened is we have horses that are very athletic in their ability to reach like this, and have we've developed horses through selective breeding that have a lot of suspension, a lot more than you saw in horses 20 or 30 years ago. And actually, I'm seeing this increase every few years. We're finding and training horses who are so incredibly athletic that their gaits really have changed a bit from what we saw years ago. The uphill balance in the horse is more bred into it, and then, of course, is enhanced by training. When the horse is in an uphill balance, they take more weight on the hindquarters and unload the forehand, and this produces the extension we see as the horse pushes off from behind. The hind legs have to come under the horse, closer to a point under the horse's center of gravity, and this is part of why we look for the reach behind also in a good extension. And so this uphill balance and the lightness of the forehand is achieved in that way. The horse also has to be able to push against the ground with the front legs, and this is part of what creates the elevation of the forehand. All of this has been researched extensively by Dr. Hillary Clayton, who's one of our foremost researchers into the dressage horse, and she's done this through the use of force plates and videos and so on, and has written extensively about this. So it's not something that I'm coming up with for sure, but something that is part of what we understand about the biomechanics of the modern dressage horse.
Now, do you talk about the breed differences and the kind of extravagant trots that differ.
Well, I just mentioned that horses are being bred to be better athletes for dressage. The breeding is more selective. The original horses that were used in dressage were, if you go back enough years, they were meant to be all-around horses, coming out of the military or cavalry tradition. And now, as it's become a sport unto itself, they're being bred more and more for that. But I think you're asking about differences among the breeds that we see today, and that's not something I addressed in the article. I was really talking about the trot as we look at it as a judge in terms of what we're looking for and what we're looking at in the way that the horse moves.
And to those points, then, give us some other ideas that would be helpful for our listeners, Jane, in terms of the training to produce the kind of trot that judges are looking for.
Well, that all depends on the horse. This really wasn't meant to be a training article. It was more about the taking the classical theory and applying it to what we see today and how actually, as we analyze gaits in a very nuanced way with video and force plates and so on, you do find some difference from what was classically understood as being the case when the naked eye was used to assess the gait. However, we can talk about the idea that a horse's conformation might predispose them to having a very extravagant front leg with minimal reach behind. You would see this in the natural motion of a particular animal, and that this is going to be harder to correct in the training process than a horse who naturally wants to match the action of the front legs and the hind legs. I do a lot of sport horse breeding type of judging, where we judge the horses in hand at the walk and the trot, and you can see, even in a young horse, a foal or yearling even, how the horse uses its front legs and its hind legs. And so taking a horse who is gifted in its natural balance makes the training process much easier. When you take a horse who's less gifted, all you can do is to maximize the talents that particular horse has, and that really comes through the classical training of the dressage horse as we know it, and really how it hasn't changed a whole lot in many years. In other words, we're looking for a horse that has the throughness and connection that the horse moves from the hind legs into the bridle and so on and so forth. Sometimes we see a horse who's naturally gifted but has not been trained in the right way. And then what you see there is often a break in the connection, the energy flow from the hind legs to the bridle. The horse becomes blocked in its back or hollow in its back, and this will produce a horse who's no longer moving with the hind canon parallel to the forearm during the trot. In other words, they move more in front than behind due to a lack of throughness, and this becomes the training problem that needs to be addressed before the horse can be more correct. This is part of what we look for as judges, is the fact that the horse is correctly trained, that it reaches into the bridle, either at the vertical or slightly in front of the vertical, that you see it taking the contact, and in an extension actually stretches more into that contact and leans a little bit, well, leaning is the wrong word, but takes a more positive feel against the bit as it pushes more strongly from behind. So the throughness is really important to a correct extension, no matter what the horse's natural talent might be.
Or whether he's an Andalusian or a Hanoverian.
That's correct.
And, of course, we all used to those wonderful images of the Spanish bred horses, the Andalusians, the Lusitanas, and a very different trot to the northern bred horses.
Right.
And I imagine quite interesting to analyze that. Did you do that as part of your research, Jane, for this?
I didn't do research, in other words, the type of research that Dr. Clayton has done, you know, with physical mm-hmm. horses. I'm not sure if that's what you're looking for. As I mentioned in the beginning, I was responding to a question that had been submitted to the Dressage Connection about the idea of some of the trots today when they're really uphill not being truly a two-beat gait, and that was the origin of the thoughts that I put right. in the article.
Right, the premise of it all, of course. Well, fascinating, I would imagine, and a topic that could be explored even further, given the differences and the comparing and contrasting between the breeds.
Well, what you'll see, I think, is if your criteria for an extension include things like suspension and reach and uphill balance and ground cover, and these are all in our dressage tests as the directives, the things you look at when you're looking at the trot, it's right there in the box next to the score box, you'll find that some horses are more capable of that than others. And it's sometimes tends to be more one way or another with given breeds, but not always, of course. Some breeds tend to offer more suspension. Some tend to offer longer, more ground-covering strides, and so on and so forth. So as you look at the various criteria that a judge must consider when giving a score for an extension, I think you find that there may be tendencies towards differences among breeds, but it's the individual horse that you're looking at and the individual meeting or not meeting those criteria that is what is counted.
Fascinating topic. Thank you very much indeed for sharing that with us, Jane. And you can read more in the USDF Connection magazine on the extravagant trot. Jane Ayres, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And next, in our Vet Connection segment, we're going to be hearing about nutrition and preventative vaccines from the U.S. equestrian team veterinarian Dr. Richard Mitchell of Fairfield Equine. This segment was recorded at the Adequan USDF Annual Convention Education Session entitled Maintenance Care of the Competitive Sport Horse.
Let's talk a little bit about nutrition. Advances have been made in recent years, in the last 15 years especially, about feeding of the sport horse. Warm bloods and quarter horses have somewhat different requirements compared to young thoroughbreds. Let's face it, 30 years ago, what was really the active athlete that really people invested large sums of money in? It was the racehorse. And those horses are young horses that are still growing and developing. And they have a different metabolism altogether as a breed, in fact, than do warm bloods and quarter horses. So we've had to rethink our plan about how we're going to feed horses and supply the appropriate nutrition. Often there's a need for adequate calories without excessive carbohydrates or starches specifically. And then we also have to consider, because our horses go to multiple competitions scattered all over the country during the year, we have to think about the effects of travel stress and how that can affect gastrointestinal health, specifically equine gastric ulcer syndrome or EGUS. Competitive sport horses are oftentimes much more mature, comparatively speaking, than the young racehorse. They have less need for high carbohydrates, and they have somewhat less need for really high protein. They may experience metabolic disease and various myopathies. We know that there are a number of warm blood breeds that are more prone to type 2 polysaccharide storage myopathy, or PSSM, and this can affect their overall function. So we need to think about how we're going to feed those horses. Concentrate feeds that provide lower carbohydrates, higher fiber, and more fat for energy are actually the way we want to think about feeding these horses. The mature warm blood horse, no more than a moderate protein of about 12%, but increased fat in the range of 9 to 12% may give this horse more energy without making it cuckoo with the high starch diets that we oftentimes use to feed the young thoroughbred. And increased fiber. Look at the fiber content of your feed. It's really important. Here's the deal. The horse is a reverse ruminant, if you want to think about it that way. Cows have a forestomach, four of them actually, a rumen, an abomasum, etc., etc. They digest the food that they get bacterially first in a big fermentation vat in the rumen. And then it goes through their small intestine and their large intestine, which is fairly not so developed as the horse's is, and they absorb the nutrients that the bacteria have produced. Well, the horse did it backwards. They have a simple stomach and intestine very much like ours, okay? And then they have a big fermentation vat in their colon, and they have a lot of bacterial action there where the bacteria produce fatty acids. And fatty acids are the major fuel for muscle, okay? So we need to think about structural carbohydrate that can be converted to energy in the colon, okay? So a higher fiber diet, without it being extremely coarse and undigestible totally, but 18% or so, okay? The basic ration should be based on good hay, okay? You don't feed grain and then throw them some extra hay. Find a good quality forage. And it, you know, many of your state extension agencies and so forth can provide you with an analysis if you can get a significant quantity of hay or you know where you're getting it on a consistent basis. You can get that hay analyzed and find out what its various nutritional values are. And then with relatively minimal expense, you can get a nutritionist to analyze and help you figure out what sort of grain ration you really should be using. You feed concentrate as a supplement to good forage. One of the things that's really important for the show horse and a competitive horse is to try to feed it multiple meals per day, rather than simply morning and night. The horse evolved to eat 20 out of 24 hours a day. They are obligate acid formers, okay? They make acid all the time. So if you're not putting something in the stomach, what is the acid going to do? It's going to work on the stomach lining, isn't it? And this is one of the reasons why horses do have a predisposition to gastric ulcers, specifically competitive horses. So trying to feed them multiple meals per day, even if it's small, and I know that can be difficult in a competitive environment, but it's still manageable, that will buffer some of the acid that's formed in their stomach. Saliva is full of bicarbonate. It is a acid buffer. The food itself is an acid buffer. And so keeping the stomach busy all the time in small quantities is a good way to manage the prevention of equine gastric ulcer syndrome. And you're going to hear me talk more and more about that because over my years of practice, that has been a major problem with the performance of good horses. So let's talk about preventive medicine with regards to infectious disease. All horses should get a tetanus shot. I don't care how sore their neck gets, they need to get a tetanus shot. It's in their environment. You get an infected wound, you don't want to have a horse with tetanus, okay? That's fundamental. But let's go beyond that. We need to talk about vaccinating for regional diseases. Certainly horses that live in maybe high northern climates may not need all of these mosquito-borne disease vaccines. But let's say for this part of the world, or certainly the southeastern United States, northeastern United States, Western equine encephalitis, Eastern equine encephalitis, and West Nile virus we want to vaccinate for. Areas in southern Texas and certainly in Mexico and South America, we need to talk about Venezuelan encephalitis. Any horses that are going to travel to the Orient to compete at all, certainly, or to Australia possibly, might want to have Japanese encephalitis. Potomac horse fever is a fairly regional disease. And it's also a very seasonal disease. And so timing with that vaccine should be oriented around the emergence of insects and so forth in the late spring and early summer. Streptococcus equi, or strangles. That disease can oftentimes be managed very well with good management. An isolation of new horses coming into your stable and so forth. But nonetheless, if you live in an area where there's a high prevalence of strangles, then that vaccine may be a necessary evil. And I say that only because there can be some significant reactions to it, but it's better to vaccinate than have the disease. Rabies, I recommend any horse in the United States get a rabies vaccine. And it, for two reasons. One, it's a ubiquitous disease, but also if your horses are exposed to the public in any way and a horse happens to bite somebody, if it's vaccinated for rabies, then it doesn't have rabies. Botulism is a disease that is prevalent in certain parts of the United States and certainly can be a very serious disease. Vaccine for that can help a great deal. It usually comes from contaminated feed sources, but having that defense on board can be very important. But it is very regional, and so you need to talk to your veterinarian about whether that's a problem in your area. Let's talk about influenza. The FEI requires initial series followed by boosters with passport documentation. I find there is a lot of confusion about flu vaccines. So I'm going to give you the bottom line tonight, okay? Because I've heard this and people mess it up, and veterinarians mess it up, and trainers mess it up, and the FEI messes it up, so let's get it right, okay? All right, so if your horse has never been vaccinated before, we want to give it vaccine on day one, okay? Then 21 to 92 days later, you give it a second flu shot. Okay? Now, that will get you a stamped passport from the USEF or the German Federation or the French Federation or whatever. But you then need to give a booster within 7 months or your initial series is null and void. Okay? That's really important. Okay? So remember that. Within 7 months, you've got to do that third injection. Then after that, only once a year. Did you know that? Once a year. You're thinking 6 months, right? No, it's once a year. Unless you're competing. Okay? Thank you, FEI, for making this so easy to understand. Okay? All right. But seriously, once a year. So if you've got a horse that's been laid up or that's not competing for one reason or another, it only needs an annual revaccination. But it must be vaccinated within 6 months and 21 days of any event that's an FEI event that it goes to. Okay? All right? So annual revaccination will keep it up, and then you don't have to go back and do all this over again. And I've seen so many people be told that they have to do this, and it's not. And I'm sorry I did not put the rule in. Go to FEI.org. and look up the vaccine requirements, and trust me, I read it before. I forgot to put the number of the rule in. So, and we've dealt with this quite a bit. So I just want you to understand that this is where we are. So all horses must be vaccinated within 6 months and 21 days of an event. But if they're not competing, they can go a year, no more than a year. So you got to keep it in within 365 days. All right. Now, rhinopneumonitis is another respiratory disease that we see that's a real significant issue. Equine herpes virus, okay? All right? And equine herpes virus, it can be a very serious disease because we know that it can cause high fevers, it can cause neurologic abnormalities, especially the wild strain. It can also cause abortion in mares. And so it is a disease that we're very concerned about, especially the wild strain that, or the neurotropic strain that can cause severe neurologic problems and even death. So the USEF has now developed a new rule that requires that all horses that go to a USEF competition must have been vaccinated within 6 months of an event for rhino and for influenza, both, okay? Now, it's not quite in line with the FEI rule. It's close. FEI doesn't have a rhino rule, okay? Just a flu rule, all right? But at least we're close, and so it makes it a little easier to kind of get on board and get synchronized with thinking about what you're going to do with your preventive vaccines. So my advice has been vaccinate for both about every 4 months. Then you don't have horses fall through the cracks. We know that the rhino vaccine probably is not always that potent, and it's not always that reliable. It's going to give you prevention. It's going to give you some level of prevention, but not 100%. And probably vaccinating more often than every 4 months could even be counterproductive from some studies that were done nearly 20 years ago, or about 20 years ago. But vaccinating every 6 months might not be enough. So just think about that and see how you can work it into your plan with your training program and so forth as to getting your horses vaccinated.
And if you'd like to read the companion article, the latest in sport horse maintenance, you can find that in the June edition of the USDF Connection magazine and on eTrack. And a reminder that declarations are now being accepted for the 2016 US Dressage Finals presented by Adequan. There is no fee to declare, but horse and rider combinations must declare at the levels and eligible divisions they intend to compete at the US Dressage Finals. To declare or for more information, go to www.usdressagefinals.com. And please note that we're starting a new summer podcast schedule here for the USDF's official podcast. The podcast episodes will be posted every other week, and you can subscribe to this podcast either on iTunes or Stitcher and follow on any podcast app to your smartphone. You can also follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook for alerts when new episodes are available. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.